It's the Unhashed Podcast. Colin, Brian, Ruben, Mario. It's the Unhashed Podcast. Telling everything that they know about the world of Bitcoin. The world of Bitcoin. Where they don't trust, they verify. You can fork yourself if you don't abide. Talking whales and bear whales. Stupid ICOs, Colin, Brian, Ruben, and Mario. It's the Unhashed Podcast.
The Unhashed Podcast.
It's the Unhashed Podcast.
The Unhashed Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to the Unhashed Podcast. I'm your host, Brian Alds. Colin, the main event, Alds, is not here, so it's me. And also not here, Mario, the gib, the jib, the slib, the nib, the tactful yet verbose, the last minute asshole, the Canadian candy man will be absent. So that means I'm rocking it with my main man, Ruben, the windmill, the Dutch rudder, the pan and coken, the little Dutch boy with his fingers in the dike, Sompson.
Hello.
All right. Well, Ruben, you know,
yep.
It's been a week for Bitcoin. And so I think we'll just go ahead and just fire it on up.
Let's do it.
All right. So diving right into the news this morning via Decrypt.co, Poolin, a Beijing-based Bitcoin mining pool that's responsible for 10% of the overall Bitcoin network hash, announced a freeze on user withdrawals on Monday. Mining pools are groups of miners that unite the efforts around one network node to mine as much Bitcoin as possible. The miners then share the spoils, but only if the pool operator has the will and the means to distribute them. Bitcoin said it was facing, quote, some liquidity issues, close quote, due to rising demand for withdrawals, and announced a measure in order to stabilize its operations. These include pausing withdrawals from its pool account and temporary suspending ETH and BTC balance payouts. The quote, the daily mine coins after September 6th will be paid out normally per day, a pool operators clarified, adding that the coins besides the top two currencies were not affected. And this is direct from the press release from Poolin. Quote, as you may know, Poolin wallet is currently facing some liquidity problems due to recent increased demand on withdrawals, but please be assured all user funds are safe and the company's net worth is positive. Though Poolin mining services are not much affected to serve the goal of stabilizing liquidity and operations, we are bringing the followings, sick, zero fee promotions and settlement adjustments, promotions, zero BTC and ETH for basically the next 3 months. So no fees on those minings. Note, zero fee applies to other coins that may take ETH hash rate after the transition. And then number two, this is why I'm reading this, exclusive 1 year zero fee offering for BTC and ETH clients. So from 1 year from September 8th to clients with more than one BTC assets in pool balance or pool account, fee will be applied by contacting the pool team members. Note, zero fee applies to other coins that may take ETH hash rate after the transition. All right. That was a lot to read. Poolin, yeah. They're not paying out fees, or sorry, they're not paying out balances that you had stored with them prior to, I think, September 6th. But
whoops.
Yep. But no, don't worry. Don't leave. Because it's zero fees for the next 3 months. And if you go double or nothing and you put one BTC back in, then it's zero fees for a year.
Oh, wait, I didn't realize they actually are encouraging deposits as well. I thought it was just people who have one BTC stuck.
Well,
which one is it? Do you know?
I mean, maybe it's if they're stuck. I guess I read it as like if you send BTC in and put it on deposit, but maybe
yeah.
Maybe it's if there's it's stuck and you like don't ask for it back out.
Yeah. No, I think if you are right about that and like people are encouraged to deposit, yeah, that's not so great. And just generally, I mean, this is the type of stuff, right? That's just like, how did they, like, all they have to do is mine the block, get the Bitcoin, distribute the Bitcoin, right? So what happened in between here? Like, what was the little, we can't pay you out. And then, the hilarious, like, the reason we can't pay you out is because too many people are asking us to pay out. It's like, yeah. That's not a reason.
Well, yeah. No, that's definitely, like, obviously they're asking you to pay out. It's their Bitcoin. Now, what I thought was most funny here, though, is the like, well, do you want to just let it ride? And and then we'll give you, because I was like thinking like, OK, like what if your bank, like you have a savings account at your bank or whatever, and you like you hear from the bank like, hey, guys, like we are insolvent and everyone's getting a haircut. But don't worry. Like if you come bring more money in, then we won't charge you any fees for the next year.
Yeah.
So I have to believe that this is a like very adversely affected hash rate. Although maybe with the zero fees, like I don't know. It's just such a weird industry where like I actually think this would work. Like there's no way this would work at a bank.
Right. Well, I mean, there's also this sort of part where the people who are already stuck in the system, they're not going to get out, right? So the question sort of is, are more people going to deposit? If that's the correct interpretation, which I'm at least judging by this text, I don't think is very clear.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
So it looks like Poolin, they were about 10% before this news broke. Now they're at 4.87. So... but they have a lot of their own miners, so I don't know like what percent, like how much of the 4% or we'll call it 5%, how much of the 5% is their own miners?
Yeah, probably a lot.
Yeah. So yeah, interesting. But it's so crazy. Like you basically had like a risk-free way to take 2% of 10% of all block rewards, and decided to gamble with it and flushed all that equity down the toilet.
That's a very likely assumption. I mean, we don't know.
Yeah,
Maybe they just lost a key or something, right? No, I agree with you. I think you are right. I very much think there was some speculation going on that went south, but we don't know. Yeah,
you're right. Okay, I mean, you're right. We do not know. I speculate along with you that they gambled and lost. It's going to be, I mean, man, the fallout from 3AC is way further reaching than I thought it would be. I mean, obviously the lending companies that we'll get to here in just a second were the obvious victims / co-collaborators. Them falling down first makes sense. I did not think we would see a pool collapse because of it.
Yeah.
It's just like such a risk-free business. Like once you build that brand equity, like that's the hard part, right? Like is getting the market share. And then you just sit back. I mean, like Slush Pool, they've seen better days. They've lost some market share for sure, but like they've been around basically forever, and they just collect 2% of 5% of all the rewards for every day for
right.
So basically so nothing.
What I'm wondering is why I do think that's some cost, but there's competition, right? So maybe what's happening here is that the pool-in fees were particularly low. And the reason they were low is because they were using the funds for something else before paying users out or something. That's the kind of thing where competition can drive fees down, and that can drive companies to do things that are risky.
Yeah. So
that's one plausible explanation as to how things could go.
Yeah, I agree.
Still not good, but
yeah. What's crazy to me is the growth of Foundry. Sitting at 22% right now. Ooh.
What's Foundry?
Foundry is the pool out of the U.S. It's relatively new, but like a lot of the U.S. miners use it.
Okay.
So as to not run afoul of.
Yeah.
Not running. They're OFAC compliant is the appeal. Oh, so the U.S. miners cannot. Well, I mean, maybe they still could, but less chance of getting in trouble.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that sounds bad for Bitcoin.
I agree. It probably is. It would be nice to see another pool in the United States so that Foundry didn't have as high of a percentage.
But why would they, like, I mean, is there like a reason why you wouldn't connect to a pool that's outside of the US? Is that just a latency issue or?
No, because all of them have mirrors, right? So there's like a US, I think there's two US, I don't even know what the word is for slush pool, like East Coast and West Coast.
Yeah.
So that's not a factor necessarily.
Yeah.
I think it's mainly regulatory.
And maybe risk, like the feeling that there is an entity that you can sue if they don't pay you out, and like pooling.
Unlike pooling, yeah. Yeah.
Maybe.
Man. Yeah. Anyway. I haven't developed all my thoughts on Foundry/OFAC compliant mining pools.
Yeah, like on one hand, like I think we're going to see more and more of this marriage between regulation and Bitcoin. And on the other hand, you don't, you know, like this could go in a direction that could be potentially problematic. And it's sort of like, you know, we're slowly slipping into this scenario where maybe at some point these OFAC compliant pools start dictating which transactions go in, which don't go in, and then we're really in a bad place. So,
well, the worst part would be if they dictate which blocks they will and won't build on top of.
Yeah.
Which would be problematic for the pool itself. So they have incentive not to do that. So maybe, like, if you were really going to steel man, you could say it might be a good thing because it's good that someone has financial incentive to lobby to make sure that that does not become law, or if it does, to like fight heavily against it. Because obviously, if you have a situation where people are mining blocks and then other people are not going to build on top of them, if, you know, whatever condition, then that's going to lower the fees for everybody. So,
well, I think, I don't know. Look, I mean, it's generally, generally it's the people that do the censoring that will lose fees, right? So it's a problem to them. They would rather not do it. But the question sort of is like, well, how many fees are they losing really by censoring a couple of transactions?
I'm not talking about the transaction fees. I'm talking about the block reward.
Okay,
and
well,
but
Well, just to paint a scenario here, right? Like, let's say we have a large fraction. Well, like, even if you have a minority, right? Like, let's say there's this OFAC compliant pool and it's 22%, like what you mentioned, and they start saying like, look, if all these other pools, if you're not compliant, we're going to try to fork you off. And so there's a risk that they succeed, right? The risk is low because they're not a majority, but the risk is there. And so that could potentially snowball into everybody becoming compliant and everybody not, you know, rather censoring a couple of transactions than to risk getting forked by this OFAC compliant pool. So, you know, you could picture a scenario like that where everybody just starts to follow the censorship because that seems like the least risky thing to do. And that's sort of like it's one potential scenario that I'm concerned with.
And the other side of that is Iran pool mines a block that is not OFAC compliant. And then Foundry sees that and says, we're not going to build on top of that. So they start doing their own work.
Yeah.
And then you have this like, well, is Iran pool going to get paid in, what is it, 100 block or 144 blocks? or is the foundry chain gonna win? Like, we don't know. And yeah. So everyone loses money because they're wasting work, is my point.
But yeah, but that's an uncertainty thing, right? Like, as soon as it's clear, like,
yeah,
like if there, yeah, it depends. Like, the game theory could work out in different ways, but it all depends on incentives, basically. So at the end of the day, it really is about how much are you censoring, how costly is that, versus what, you know, what these pools are being pressured into doing from governments. And there's a cost on both sides. Yeah. There's a cost to not mining. There's a cost to not following regulations or lobbying, even, right? So I think the money that is potentially left on the table by censoring is sort of the money that's available to lobby the governments to not censor. And yeah, how that works out, I don't know. But it's definitely something that is potentially concerning.
Yeah, that is interesting. I also think, like, you can't, just like we saw with Poulin, like, none of these percentages are static. And so if things start, you know.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that, like, Foundry announces they're going to do that and then they stay at 22%. Yeah. Like, maybe they fall to 15 or 10 or 0. So. Like, we don't know. Yeah. So that also works into the game theory. All right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Dead horse. Very dead.
All right.
News item 2, numbered as number 3 for us. A bombshell new filing by the Vermont Department of Financial Regulation. In the Chapter 11 proceedings of the Celsius Network makes the case that the crypto lender was effectively insolvent, not just after the crypto market declines of early 2022, but as early as 2019, the crypto lending firm admitted to investigators that, quote, that the company had never earned enough revenue to support the yields being paid to investors, close quote. The filing furthers the claim that its financial analysis, quote, suggests that at least at some point in time, yields to existing Celsius investors were probably being paid with the assets of new investors, close quote. And that means that Celsius is a Ponzi scheme.
Whoops.
What, whoa. Imagine that. 20% interest rate means it's a Ponzi scheme.
Well, 2019 is interesting, though. I was expecting them to
have
already been messed up so early on. So, yeah.
Yeah. So, old Mischewski, man. And like the whole time he's pumping like how he can pay yield on gold and all kinds of crazy shit. So.
Yeah.
Which, like, as soon as he said that, like, alarm bells, like, wait a second, like, you're going to pay yield on like a shiny metal object, like sitting in a vault somewhere, like the like,
yep.
No one's borrowing that, man. Like, anyway. All right.
Weird little market there, yeah.
Yeah, that's all I got from that. I don't know. Do you have anything?
Nope.
All right. Number 4. From the Block.co, several employees of leading crypto exchange Coinbase are following suit to roll back last month's Tornado Cash sanctions. Coinbase itself is financially backing the suit. The lawsuit centers on the novel argument whether the U.S. government can target recurring code for national security purposes. The employees filed the suit in the U.S. District Court for the Western District of Texas. Quote, people or entities or properties are fair game. Code is not, close quote, Paul Gerwal, Coinbase's chief legal officer, told The Block. The case comes exactly 1 month at the U.S. Treasury's Office of Foreign Asset Controls, OFAC, added Tornado Cash to its specifically designated nationals list, saying the decentralized crypto mixer, quote, has been used to launder more than $7 billion worth of virtual currencies, close quote. I thought this was interesting and really cool. Coinbase, obviously, you know, they're one of our whipping boys here, but I love to give credit where credit is due. And so I appreciate Coinbase stepping up to the plate here. Even though I'm sure that this is like within their financial interest to do this. I also think it's within the broader crypto realms interest. So I appreciate them stepping up and poning the bill.
Yeah. I mean, there's a weird, like, right, like Coinbase is sort of, it's problematic how they're intertwined with government, but at the same time, they're also obviously, like, they want as much money to come into crypto, and they want to be the gatekeepers at the same time, right? Like, it's sort of like they have this double role where I think this is sort of the, well, yeah, they don't want the golden goose to be killed. And I think the Tornado Cash thing, where suddenly a smart contract becomes illegal, that is very much killing the golden goose. So they would like that golden goose to be alive, but they also want to seek rent on the golden goose. So it's like double-edged sword there, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. And like, it's definitely a contagion type scenario where if this happens to one piece of code, then, you know, what's next, what's next, what's next, what's next? And so, like, the line is at the first, you know, the first time you do it. Like, you can't let it keep happening, because then there's no telling how much that will affect crypto, but I guess, yeah, more importantly for Coinbase, affect their business.
Yeah, and I mean, the Tornado Cash thing is quite problematic. I had a discussion with George Provost after the last podcast we did. I don't think I can quite remember. I should have gone back and read it, but basically, you know, these sort of open question is, how much control does the Tornado Cash developer have, or at least the guy that got, like, arrested, whether or not he was profiting from these transactions? And I think the conclusion that Shores and I came to was that it's basically, there's sort of a default that's built into the network that causes money to go to the developer, but it's a default that users could circumvent if they really want it. So you could make the argument that sort of like, well, it's sort of a voluntary payment in the sense that it's not network enforced that the developer is getting paid.
Yeah,
and I guess you could make that argument more broadly in saying, well, you could fork the code, or you could make a version where the developer doesn't get paid. That's probably true also.
That was my read on what you just said. There's another mechanism that whereby you do not have to pay the developer.
Yeah, well, I understand why you're. It's a subtle difference, but one difference is that you don't. You use the same code. You use the same on-chain code, but your off-chain software acts differently, such that you don't pay a fee, or you just fork the entire code on-chain, and you get rid of the fees. Like both are sort of viable paths, yeah, I would say. But well,
I guess the latter, if you forked the code completely, then you would have a new liquidity pool.
Yes.
Or a new tumbling pool, whatever. Yeah. And so then you're going to have to, like, rebuild that part from scratch is my novice on it.
It's more complicated if you were to go that path, I think, but it's all, like, theoretically doable. And, but, you know, like, it comes, it really, I mean, these are sort of like open questions to me that I don't really have an answer to. But the question sort of is like, well, how, to what degree can you hold a developer responsible? And, you know, there have been discussions in the past where, you know, things were said along the lines of, you're allowed to build the software, but you're not allowed to run the software, right? Like, if you're a market maker to something illegal, then you're going to get into trouble. But if you create the software that allows other people to be market makers, then maybe you're okay. And sort of the question is like, what is it that is being considered illegal here?
Yeah.
Why did the Tornado Cash developer get arrested? And it's not clear. Like, nobody really knows what's going on. And I certainly hope, like, I hope it just all ends with everything being fine at the end, but who knows? And if he isn't fine, then I hope the specific reason is that he was putting himself in the middle of these transactions somehow and profiting off of these transactions.
Yeah. Well, it is like, he's definitely somewhere in the middle between those two things, between, like, I am a market maker, like a traditional Bitcoin tumbler. Like, people running servers, and, you know, they accept transactions and they send out new ones, and, like, I wrote this piece of software, so, and just released it into the wild, and you know you're using it to encrypt files, like I don't have anything to do with it or whatever. So yes, clarity would be nice here. I mean, obviously not that anyone cares what I think, especially over in the EU, but like, it's crazy to me as an American, and maybe just as a human, that you can like arrest someone and not specifically charge him.
Yeah.
That is pretty crazy to me. And a bit scary, to be honest.
Yeah. I don't know what's going on there. And so I just don't know enough about that, but like, certainly that has to become clear over time. If it never becomes clear, that sounds just ridiculous. So I share that concern, and very specifically, like, I think either way, it's a problem. Like, even if you're not allowed to be a market maker, I think that's a problem too. But then at least there's sort of a way to fight back where the market makers can be anonymous. The developer doesn't have to be a market maker. And that's still not ideal. And I still think, you know, that's sort of like, if you do a coin join with other people, is that illegal, right? Because you're sort of, okay, you're helping people being anonymous. And you could say, like, those are illegal transactions. But then it's like, well, are they illegal? Do you know they're illegal? Are you just trying to get privacy for yourself and finding other people that presumably are trying to get privacy? Like, why would that be illegal? So, yeah, I really don't think it should be illegal either way. But, yeah, this is where we are right now. And it is definitely concerning. And, if there is anything else you want to add, go ahead. Otherwise, I'm going to point to a tweet that's related to this.
Yeah, I just one thing, like, I would think there should be a market for a Tumblr, CoinJoin, whatever you want to call it, Tornado Cash thingy, that does not allow OFAC sanctioned addresses into it, because if you're coming in with relatively clean coins, or let's just say like completely squeaky clean coins, and like I think we've said this before, like your coins are going to be dirtier coming out, like on a just average basis, like almost certainly. So so like, you should if you have clean, good coins, you probably shouldn't be sending them through these things.
I mean, that depends on what
there
you
are.
Want,
there is some, there's some utility to like having, like coins at an address that has no tie to you. I get that. But like, you kind of need to step through like what you're actually going to be using this for, before you do that.
Yeah, but that is, I think that's already sort of the consequence of these regulations where users have to care about that. Like in the ideal world, like what I care about is just my coins are anonymous and I want them to be anonymous by mixing them with other people. And now you don't know if my coins are dirty or clean. You don't know. They could be dirty. They could be clean. And that's good and all because now I'm anonymous.
Definitely.
I think your argument is like sort of like, well, and I think it makes sense, right? Like rationally and from the selfish perspective, it makes sense because you don't want your coins to be dirtier than they were, right? Like I totally get that, but it's also like, I think it's also a concession or sort of like giving up on the idea that we can have fully
fungible
coins. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I agree. I guess after I said that, I was like, well, the ideal is like, if I have a $10 bill in my pocket, like I don't care that like a drug dealer had it two times ago.
Yeah.
Or two transactions ago. So like, why should I care about the Bitcoin? And I guess if we can get some type of on-chain fungibility I don't know, ring signatures or what, I don't know. Crazy Ruben tech that would help us in that regard for sure, and that would be the ideal. Like, it's just money, you shouldn't care about where it came from.
Yeah, and also like let's say we did have this distinction, right? Where, okay, a couple of addresses are just like no touch addresses. Nobody wants to touch them, get money that is correlated to dead output. Okay. But how did we get to that point, right? Because like, I mean, I guess there are certain ways to get to that point, but like, if all the coins are anonymous all the time and you have sort of whitelisted, reasonably anonymous coins, because these whitelisted coins are all mixing with each other. So you sort of know like, okay, well, this is within the pool of okay coins. Then how do these coins become black at some point, right? Like how do they get on the LFAC list? Like what would have to happen? And would that be detectable given that these coins might be sufficiently anonymous?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe it is like, you know, when there's like an exchange hack or something, and you can probably like sort of figure out like, okay, where did the coins go or something. But even then you also have these problems like, okay, well, let's say the exchange hack happened, right? And right away, right after the hack, as the hack occurs, before people even realize what's going on, the coins are already being laundered with all these white coins, right?
Yeah.
How do you treat that? Do you just say like, okay, well, the hacker gets to keep those coins, I guess? Maybe.
Yeah. It's not an easy question.
Yeah.
Why do hackers always got to go around and shit where I'm eating?
Well, you know? They like money. They want to be rich.
These people wanting all this money.
Yeah.
Ugh, now I sound like an old man. Back in my day,
we didn't care about money. I don't think.
Yeah. True. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. No. They think they didn't.
Yeah. There
wasn't all this hacking going on. Yeah. Jesse James just broke open the stagecoach, shot him right in the face. All right.
I mean, but
back when things were civilized.
I mean, it's kind of true, right? Because like, I mean, the hacking thing is so different. Like, you know, like your front door is like a hacker. Well, someone who wants to get into your house has to physically come to your door. But if you're on the internet, your door is like everywhere, right? Like it's like,
yeah.
Like any, the hacker can always be in front of your door trying to get in. Whereas in the physical world, there's some sort of like limitation with like locality. That is definitely sort of a security advantage.
Yeah, but also, like, there's no, I mean, there is theft and, like, stealing of value, but there's no violence, usually, in a digital-type hack.
Right, yeah.
So
the libertarian argument is that hacking is okay.
And there you go.
So if you're a libertarian, you should allow yourself to get hacked or not complain about it.
Yeah.
Just be like, yep. Yeah, they didn't hurt you. They didn't threaten you.
They just took all your stuff.
Yep.
Stop.
It wasn't yours to begin with, I guess.
Stop bitching. Yeah. Not your keys, not your coins, really.
Yeah. Something like that.
Yeah.
No longer your keys.
Yeah, no longer your keys, no longer your coins. Yeah. All right.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of, we kind of have two related tweets.
One related
literature.
So let's go to the NoPara tweet.
All right, let's do it.
So NoPara, which is the Wasabi developer, he put out a tweet asking, does anyone know what's up with Chris Belcher, inventor of Join Market? A few months ago, he disappeared. And I've been asking around a little bit. I've been meaning to ask. So I asked Adam Gibson. He didn't know, Waxwing. I've been wanting to ask Connor Okus, who did a video with him, and that's the sort of the last thing that Chris Belcher tweeted. So maybe I'll go and ask Connor, see if he knows what's up. But he went completely off the radar, and this is very concerning. And so my tweet response was, I hope this wasn't a chilling effect from what happened to the Tornado Cash developer. And I think it very well could be. Like, I'm just completely speculating. I have no information and been unable to find anyone who knows anything. But, like, this is really bad. And joint market is... So the way joint market works is there is a money-making element, which is that you have market makers and market takers. And, I personally wouldn't be surprised if Belcher himself was a big market maker on his own joint market implementation, even though that was never like publicly said, or, you know, technically we don't know who is the market maker. It would not surprise me who the market makers are, at least. So I see some analogies there, and I see a reason for concern. So maybe that's why Chris just sort of went under the radar. And that would be very sad, because like joint market is a very, very important project. And then there's another project that he's been working on, which is it's a coin swap protocol. I think he called it Teleport, if I remember correctly. And that's like yet another sort of like, it's a variant of CoinJoin in the sense that, with CoinJoin, what you're doing is sort of, you have a bunch of inputs, you have a bunch of outputs, and you don't know how to correlate them, but you at least know, like, if you know someone who had an input, you know one of these outputs probably belongs to them. And with CoinSwap, you actually have a better sort of potential anonymity set, in the sense that you see one coin moving from Alice to Bob, and a couple of hours later, you see one coin moving from Carol to Dave. And actually what happened is that two people were swapping their coins, and you can't really see any on-chain evidence of that. And this can be made even better with, if you use different amounts. Let's say you make a payment, and then the change address is a coin swap and things like that. And you can do some smart things there that are really great for anonymity. And that's what Chris was working on. And now if he really is just gone, like maybe he's just on vacation and he didn't tell anyone, like, I don't know. But if he's really gone, and no longer working on this, that's a massive loss to Bitcoin. And the question sort of becomes, well, who's going to pick up this slack and do it given the risks involved? Or are we just going to get a bunch of pseudonyms doing the work?
Yeah. I do prefer known named devs. I don't know why. Maybe I shouldn't care, but
yeah. Well, if the code is like, yeah, I mean, it's difficult, right? Because like, I think the peer review process is one where I guess the pseudonym can have a reputation, right? So you can have pseudonyms that you trust as well, as opposed to known people. But I do think it's harder to build a trust relationship with someone like that. And I think peer review is sort of a trust relationship where you say, like, look, I trust these people to have checked the code, and therefore I trust the code. So that I think it makes sense, at least that it's harder, but not impossible to build trust relationships with pseudonyms. Yeah.
Yeah. All right.
And I think the best way of being a pseudonym is maybe like disappearing every now and then and coming back as a different pseudonym. And at least that's what I've seen a lot. And I've even, even with my own work, I'm noticing this where, my silent payments protocol is, there were two pseudonymous developers working on it. And one of them, W0XLT, he's still working on it. And, we don't know who he is. And then there's this other guy, Libra. And that guy, he went completely off the radar too. And I suspect it's very similarly related to this Tornado Cash thing, where he deleted his Telegram, he deleted his GitHub account, he deleted his, everything. On Twitter, yeah. He's gone. And he was doing great work. And he was creating like a mobile wallet that would accept silent payments and was compatible with... the other pseudonym W0XLT, his work, and so like that's just gone. Like he's gone. Yeah. His work is gone.
And maybe even more importantly, like the corporate knowledge he had of like how it was all working, like as a team member, that's hard to rebuild.
Yeah, and I invested time in him, like helping him out, like understanding the protocol, right? Like that's just in the hopes that he would like carry it forward and. yeah, I even talked to him about like potentially him writing a BIP. And but it's even like in this case, I think it's even extreme, because like for something like CoinJoin, for CoinJoins where there are market makers and there's money to be made, I sort of understand it. But like the silent payment protocol is not even like, I don't even think it's that like extreme or risky or something you should be worried about in terms of government interference. But like, maybe that's me being naive or something, like, I don't know. But like, it's because the protocol is essentially something, it makes a process that you can already do interactively, it makes it non-interactive. So normally, if you want to receive a payment, you just create a new address, you give it to the person, and they pay you. And in this case, you can do it in a non-interactive way. So it's sort of like, you're not gaining anonymity compared to what we already could do. It just becomes easier to hand out fresh addresses that are not correlated. So yeah. I don't really see it as something extreme. I don't see a money-making aspect here. I guess you could create a wallet where you try to make money as well. I mean, that's always possible. But so from my perspective, it's like, it's not even a thing where you should be worried. And then we have developers disappearing even there, right? Like, even there are people that are concerned about it. And I think it's telling that the two guys that are working on it are pseudonyms.
Yeah, it is. That is interesting. An interesting like anecdote of how this has an effect in the wild.
Yeah.
And it is an anecdote, you know, maybe he left because he's, you know, had a baby, something, I don't know. yeah, it's a possibility. But yeah, it, like the timing does obviously make you suspect one thing or another. And maybe he'll come back in 6 months and, you know, as a new pseudonym. And
yeah, it's like, oh, I went on a meditation retreat. I'm back.
Yeah. He went down to Brazil to do ayahuasca.
yeah.
He has like all kinds of new like connections insights into how to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah. Entirely possible. He sees the universe in a different light.
Yeah.
And let's hope that's that's what happened. But yeah, like regardless of these anecdotal, I agree, like we can't know with any of these cases like what happened, but like just looking at the whole picture, and even within the Bitcoin core developers, right, and them being sued, and just like the number of chilling effects that are surrounding these projects, it has a direct effect, right? Like, why would you risk potentially going to jail, getting arrested, getting sued, when you could be doing other stuff where that isn't a risk, right?
Yeah.
Like it's real, it's a cost. And it's really sad that affects like how people behave. And I haven't personally felt that, but you know, maybe at some point I will start to feel like that. And just the fact that that's possible, like I find that very, very unfortunate.
Yeah, it's definitely sad. And to kind of go back a little, like, two things. Like, one, like, these are really talented people, so there's plenty of competition for their attention. And so like, it doesn't take much to like make giving away their time for free to be a too big of a marginal cost or a risk, or, you know, however they want to weigh it. So, you know, there's not a lot keeping them there other than just like personal satisfaction and curiosity and kind of solving a Rubik's cube, if you will, a Rubin cube in this case. But also one thing like we also don't know is like, I don't know anything about the Tornado Cash guy personally. And already we've said like he should be charged, but we don't know the full story. Like, maybe, again, I have no idea if this is true or not, but it is possible like he's getting like direct payments from the North Korean government, or, you know, like, there probably is way more to the story than we know. And maybe it's completely exculpatory for him, and maybe it's not. And so until we know that, like, I think when we know that and know the full story, which I think we'll have to, if they're going to like hold this guy for too much longer, then that will, we can read a lot. We'll have a lot more tea leaves to read at that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, so yeah, it's hard to know exactly, but like either way, like it just looks really bad what happened to the Tornado Cash developer. 100%. Like even if he's taking fees, right? Like even then, I think it's like I can understand it better that they might have a case against him, but I still think it's bad. Yeah, very bad.
Yeah, yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. All right. Well, one thing that's not bad and that actually is really good is Leaden.io.
Oh.
And today's episode of the Unhashed Project is brought to you by Leaden.io, a better home for your Bitcoin. Leaden is a suite of institutional-grade services that can help you manage and optimize your digital wealth. Leaden pays an industry-leading return on USDC, and they also let you earn up to 5.25% on your Bitcoin. You can also access dollar-backed loans if you need cash but you don't want to sell. And their B2X loan, you can get a Bitcoin-backed loan to double your Bitcoin holdings and avoid paying taxes, depending on your jurisdiction. We've been longtime Leaden clients. Their service has been sterling for me thus far. And so you should check them out at Leaden.io. Do your own research and learn how they can help you. That's Leaden.io.
Cool. All right. Well, that brings us to the final tweet.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
So this tweet is Fernando. He retweeted a CNN article, a video that I guess I'll summarize. Yeah. Do you know the story or?
I know the story. I have seen this guy. I have no idea who he is, though.
The
Fernando Needham. F Needham.
Yeah. So he's, like him and I, like we see eye to eye on a lot of Bitcoin related things. And so I discuss a lot of stuff with him on Twitter. But like, it doesn't really matter. Like, it's just, I just wanted to give him credits for retweeting this. The point is not Fernando. The point is the CNN story. So the, CNN story is, and I don't know much background other than this little video, but I just thought it was sort of interesting where there's a proposal in Los Angeles to, in 2024, to have hotels with vacant rooms give them up to homeless people. So the idea is to allow homeless people into the rooms that are not being used for the night in order to get them off the streets. And there's going to be a vote on this. And if the people of Los Angeles vote yes, then in 2024, this is actually going to be a thing. And personally, I just thought this was like one of those things where it sounds nice on paper. Right? You're like, oh, we got free rooms, right? We got available rooms. And then we got all these people that don't have a room. They're on the street. So what if we put the people in the rooms? And I see how that is theoretically appealing, but I think it's just gonna catastrophically fail in practice. I don't see how this could like ever end up working out. I don't know what your opinion is, but I just thought it was so ridiculous that I thought it would be fun to talk about.
Well, and Fernando's comment on the retweet is, "Aren't you relieved this will be decided democratically?" which is I'm blanking, but that's as good as a quote tweet as you could get for that, I think. Very, very well sums up how I think about it too. And obviously I'm sure he's being sarcastic. Like obviously it's going to fail. Like there won't be any more rooms for homeless people. There will just be less hotels.
Maybe you're right, but like, why do you say that?
Because the hotels will just close before they house these people. Like they're going to just destroy the rooms if.
Yeah.
And so then I have the cost of like cleaning this like cesspool that is left behind. Like, and they're not going to leave. Right. So like, I have 50 free rooms on Wednesday, but then on Thursday they're all filled. Oh, I'm going to put homeless people in there on Wednesday night. Oh, there's no way that so like there's no way a hotel can turn a profit if they're having to like house these people. And so
yeah,
they'll just close.
So you'd rather not have vacancies, what you're saying. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd just rather not have a hotel.
Yeah.
Now, I mean, there's probably going to be some like nuance in the law, like
I mean, hotel costs go up, I guess, but yeah.
A property owner must like give out like up to 10% of his rooms, and so my guess is like they'll just build some like shanty town hotels. And like that's our homeless people hotel, and we send them there, and then just, like it's just continuously they just turn it over to them, you know, like I don't know, this is your problem now. And then like, yeah, those are my hotel rooms that I'm giving out. And then like my Beverly Hills, I mean, because let's say that you're paying like $600 or $700 a night for like a Beverly Hills hotel room, like you don't even want like that person in like on your floor.
As your neighbor,
you know, much less like being your neighbor or being your like having been in the room that you've been in at, you know, like the night before
in the elevator,
like,
together.
There's no way there's no way that the people who spend that much on a hotel are going to put up with that. So anyway,
so
that's my read.
This was a little funny,
But LA is a cesspool. California, on a whole, or the large cities in California, I should say. There's a lot of beautiful places in California, but the large cities are turning into complete shitholes. And so, like, it won't surprise me if this passes and they actually make them do it. It'll just kind of like further the decline.
I will tell you, as like a European person, I don't understand the American homeless problem. Like why are you failing so catastrophically to get these people in some nicer or better environment? I understand the homeless problem in general, where like there are just certain people that are just sort of, they just want to be vagrants and they don't settle for anything else, but like, or they have mental illnesses, but like it just seems more solvable than what is happening. And it seems like in the US in particular, you guys are doing a terrible job, and I wonder why that's such an extreme over there compared to other places.
Well, here's the dirty, not so secret is that homelessness is a business. And the more homeless people there are, the more money from the government, the bureaucracies and organizations and stuff get to help take care of it. So it's encouraged. Subsidized. And it's all cash, right? Like, if you get given, like, there's no telling. I don't know what the number is for California. I'm sure it's in the hundreds of billions of dollars that they spend on, quote, fighting homelessness or solving homelessness. Some of it just like giving out cash, like how do you account for cash or even like things that you, quote, gave out to homeless people? We gave out food to them. You know, there's no way to account for that.
Yeah.
So it's all just slush money.
Oh, so, really?
But then the more homeless people there are, the more money you can justify getting.
Yeah. Man, that sounds insane.
Yeah. There's a really interesting Joe Rogan about it, that, you know, he was talking with a guy who did some like deep investigative journalism about it. And yeah, homelessness is a business, and the more homeless people there are, the more the people can extract for it. To solve it,
I see. Okay.
Quote unquote.
Yeah. Well, at least that sounds like one plausible explanation, and yeah, it does. Otherwise, I just find it, impossible to explain. So, yeah, makes sense to me.
Yeah, it is crazy, and it's sad for people who like own property in areas where, like, oh, that's the homeless encampment now, and then they're growing and spreading. So, like, Venice Beach is like a nice area in LA, and now it's just like turning into homeless encampment. And like even the beach itself, So you're talking about like beach property in the middle of LA, and now there's like homeless people living all on the beach and like leaving hypodermic needles and stuff. Like, imagine if you had like millions of dollars, or what used to be, you know, tens of millions of dollars in property on the beach, and then now it's, you know, you have to walk through hypodermic needles, or you get assaulted when you go out there. You know, no one's gonna want to live there.
Yeah,
it's crazy. Really sad.
Yeah.
Well, we solved the tornado cash thing, and we solved homelessness in California. So, you know,
perfect.
I think we can call that a day.
Well, Brian, what did Bitcoin's price do?
Yeah, for the price analysis section, number go down slightly. So that concludes price analysis. And yeah, I don't think we have anything else. Unfortunately, no, there's no lightning round. So there we go. Lightning Network didn't pay their sponsorship for this episode. So maybe next time.
Darn.
If someone could reach out to the CEO, that would be great. All right. Well, this has been the Unhashed Podcast, a show that brings you down to earth and cuts through all the blockchain bullshit. I've been your host, Brian Alds. Thank you for listening. We love you. Goodbye.
It's time to thank the people who are making the show happen. VIP patrons. MKUltra07, thanks so much for your contributions. If you want to help contribute, you can go to patreon.com/unhashpodcast or send Bitcoin to the address on the About page of unhashpodcast.com. Thank you for your consideration.